Monster Professor.
Welcome to the Monster Professor, a show in which we discuss and explore monsters in literature, myth, film, games, folklore, culture, and beyond. I'm your host, Josh Woods, author, editor, professor, and monster expert. One quick housekeeping note for today's episode. There is an excellent literary press in North Carolina called Press 53. Actually, one of the top small presses in the nation now. And they have a really cool writing contest. It's free to enter. It's fun to try out. It's a 53-word story contest. And you can check them out at press53.com or just Google the Press 53 word story contest. They're taking entries in December. They have a really cool prompt for it. They have all their rules about how to do your 53 word story, which is pretty fun. And it's just free to send in. I mentioned this because the judge for this December's 53 word contest is yours truly, the Monster Professor Josh Woods. You know, you don't have to write about monsters just because I'm the judge. Follow that prompt, and I'm looking for the best ones. So check that out. Speaking of Press 53, my guest for today's episode has one book out through Press 53 and several anthologies out through it. His book through Press 53 is called Miracle Boy and Other Stories, an excellent book. The anthology series he and Laura Benedict put together are called Surreal South. He's got other books out there as well, Town Smokes, The Wrecking Yard, Dogs of God, and his name is Pinkney Benedict. I had the pleasure of speaking with him several episodes back about werewolves, and today I get to talk to him about the Addams Family, the Munsters, and in general, monstrous families. First of all, thanks for coming on the podcast again, coming back on the Monster pleasure. Professor.
My pleasure. I have to admit that when I heard not too long ago during your show, I heard that you were going to only every 2 weeks. I kind of fell apart for a little while. Figure out what I was going to do. I've gotten in the habit of I listen to it. I take a long walk outdoors every Saturday morning. And that's been my Monster Professor time, like, just, you know, being a Monster Professor out walking. And now I'm like, oh, what am I going to do every other Saturday? What am I going to listen to? So, I have yet to find a replacement, but I believe that I know what your secret project is, and I will not drop any spoilers, but suffice it to say, I'm very excited about it, and it is definitely worth your dropping back on your production schedule.
Well, thanks for the compliment and the plug on the secret project. I was worried that people would turn into monsters who were really enjoying the show weekly, but I think it'll be worth it. I think we can pick back up to once a week eventually. Well, you and I were talking. I don't even remember what got us on the subject. I guess we were texting, or I don't remember what it was exactly. And we started talking about Addams Family and then Munsters and Addams Family Munsters. And after like five or six back and forths, we were like, "Man, we should just make this a podcast."
Right, that's a show. That's a show. Yeah.
And so, because I mean, the Addams Family, and the Munsters, they were both on as reruns when I was growing up. Then the Addams Family movie in the 90s, when that came out with like Raul Julia.
I guess that's my question for you. Is that, yeah. So you knew the Addams Family before the Raul Julia, and is it Angelica Houston plays Morticia? And Christopher Lloyd plays Uncle Fester.
God, yes, he's amazing.
He's actually, for my money, he's the only, and your viewers, I guess you don't have viewers, but your listeners can't see me, but I bear a certain resemblance to Uncle Fester. and in fact, I will admit that my wife, when she is irritated with me, calls me Uncle Fester. So I have a particular fondness for Uncle Fester, but I thought Christopher Lloyd, I guess it was Jackie Coogan, in the TV show. Yeah, Jackie Coogan was a child actor. He was one of these guys who, was really, really popular, I guess, in film, you know, when he was a little kid. And then he grew up to become, the initial Uncle Fester. But then it was Christopher Lloyd in the film. And I think Christopher Lloyd was brilliant at it. But for me, the Addams Family is, less the films from the 90s and perhaps into the 2000s. I don't know when the latest incarnation was, than it is the television show. And actually for me, even before the television show, the Addams Family was not called the Addams Family. I didn't know the name, the Addams Family. I just knew, my parents had a collection of Charles Addams drawings called Drawn and Quartered. And I remember running across that as a little kid and long before I understood those cartoons at all. And another thing they also had that had some of these Charles Addams cartoons was, it was this compendium of, New Yorker cartoons from like the 20s through the 40s. I remember they kind of went through the end of World War II. And, for me, and I know you've talked about this a lot, on the show, and your guests tend to talk about it. Is how we were affected by things that we encountered when we were young and impressionable.
Yeah.
Right. And how that stuff has stayed with us. Well, these were cartoons to which I just had no access. Like I was a little kid living in, you know, rural West Virginia on a farm. And these were these, you know, this would have been in the 70s, say. And these were these ultra sophisticated urban cartoons from, you know, the 20s through the 40s. And like I knew they were cartoons, so I knew they were probably supposed to be funny. But none of the, you know, like the punchlines didn't make sense to me. They didn't seem funny. But they were so evocative somehow, right? Yeah. Like so atmospheric, you know? And I remember long before I even knew about the Addams Family characters, I remember a cartoon of a guy, it was the U.S. Patent Office. And it was a guy, you know, obviously a patent officer kind of leaning out his window of what's obviously a skyscraper with this kind of weird ray gun looking weapon and a guy in a lab coat behind him, who's clearly the inventor who's brought this thing in to the patent office. And the guy's leaning out the window and he says, "Death ray fiddlesticks. It doesn't even slow them up." and that's kind of the one of the first Charles Addams cartoons I remember. But see, my guess is, I don't know what your listenership is, but that many folks who are listening to the podcast, even if they know about the Charles Addams cartoons and they probably know about the TV show, their first encounter with it is through the films.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't, I was just aware of them. Like I'd maybe seen a couple of episodes, of both Munsters and Addams before I ran into the Addams Family movie. But I didn't find out till years later. It started as this cartoon by Charles Addams in the New Yorker. And then when I saw them, first of all, yeah, they have this quality to them that's like fascinating and kind of cutesy and beautiful at the same time. And you're waiting for, since they're like these one panel images, you're waiting for like a Far Side kind of punchline at the bottom or something. And they never happen. You're hanging out with the Addams Family. Like one of them, I remember like the grandmother witch is bending over this gothic kind of oven, and then Wednesday and Pugsley on either side of her, and she's pulling these cookies out of the oven, and you're waiting, you know, you're looking at like, what's on the cookies? And they're like, you know, little bat cookies and skulls, and And that's it. And we do that right now for Halloween. Like, maybe that was crazy right. then, but really, I mean, what's the punchline of the craziness? It's nothing really. It's you just get to hang out with this family. And I think that's one of the greatest things that 90s movie did for me is like, you know, I was a young teen at the time and I was already discovering or realizing how freaking weird I am. And I'm like, where do I belong? I can't figure out what I am. And then I watch the Addams Family. I'm like, I'm an Addams. I'm just a misplaced Addams is all I am. I think I even had the poster in my bedroom of the Addams Family. I don't know.
Well, yeah. And there, you know, and there's so many appealing things to go to the television show and also the film, but I think this quality is actually also there in the comics. I don't think I'm backfilling this. Is that, for instance, between the characters who became Gomez and Mortician, of course, in the cartoons they're nameless.
Yeah.
And I like that nameless quality. Like, I like the fact that we didn't even know, like, we didn't even know their relationships. We didn't know that's the grandmother or the uncle, or, you know, they're just this like tribe.
Yeah, I remember some of his old writings about him when he's like, you know, thought webbing what these things are. And for the bio under Gomez Addams, he's like, you know, his something about his marriage to Morticia, if indeed they're even married at all.
You know, that's the thing. Like, why would they be? I mean, yeah. You know, it's not, and who's going to marry them? Like a Presbyterian minister? You know, I mean, they're not, you know, so are they married? Is she alive? I mean, she certainly looks corpse-like, right?
Yeah.
And maybe she's even a, you know, she's a vampire or something, but they're both, I mean, the thing that attracts me to them is they really seem sincerely to have a romantic love between them.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like they really, they aren't, you know, they aren't disaffected. They aren't, you know, they're really attracted to each other. And Morticia, you know, and again, maybe I confess, you know, more than I should, but I mean, you know, as a boy, you know, I'm looking at Morticia and I'm like, whoa. That's you. You know, and I mean erotic imagery when you're growing up on a farm in the 70s in West Virginia is hard to come by, right? And so I'm looking at Charles Addams as drawn on and quartered, you know, and I'm like, whoa, which will, to the internet age of folks, that will perhaps sound perverse beyond belief.
Yeah, so
but I mean, I really like that. Like, I like the fact that he, the husband, or who became Gomez, that he understood, you know, that you know, his wife was beautiful, you know, that you know, and desirable, even though she was also spooky. And there that quality of terror and attractiveness. I remember when my daughter was a little girl, we bought her this costume. And oh, she wanted this so badly. She wore it, you know, Halloween after Halloween, and it was Spiderella. And you know, it was nothing. It was just, you know, some cheap rayon. Like, there was a black cloak with, I remember it had this kind of orange, like almost like foam rubber collar that stood up behind her head that had a spider web on it. And I you know, did she wear like pale makeup or something? But it, you know, it was really, you know, it was a sort of pseudo Morticia outfit. And her description of it, and we did not put this in her mouth, you know, but I remember her as a little girl. What could she have been? 7? You know, and she says, Spiderella is spooky, but also beautiful. And so now, you know, I mean, that's kind of our watchword for that, you know, things that are spooky, but also beautiful.
Yeah.
Right. And I love that. Like, that captures so much of what those cartoons were for me, is they were, like you say, they weren't punchlines. I didn't read them to go, ha ha, you know, they put one over on the Straits or whatever. It was like, oh, it was this being able to look into this sort of erotically charged, scary space that was also deeply aesthetically pleasing and unified.
Yeah.
Like, every part of that house that you looked at, like Hill House, right? And you've talked about Hill House on your show. Like Hill House, every part of it you looked at, like, they wouldn't necessarily all go together. I couldn't draw you a schematic of their house. At the same time, if you showed me a picture and said, is this part of their house? Is this not part of their house? I would know.
Yeah.
Right. I would, because the aesthetic was so powerful and so complete and so pleasing. You know, I mean, it really was spooky, but also beautiful.
Yeah. Hell, we should do the Gothic game show in which I show you an image like, which Gothic house is this? The Adams.
That would be great. I mean, oh, that's definitely, that's the Castle of Otranto. No question about it. I can tell because there's a huge helmet lying on top of it, dude. That made me laugh. I'm walking around and you're talking about the Castle of Otranto and the big helmet that just falls from the sky. And I haven't read the Castle of Otranto since I was an undergraduate, probably, and I probably never will again.
Not that good, but it's crazy.
Well, it's something you ought to read, right? I mean, there are books that you read and then you don't ever have to read them again. But you ought to have read them.
Yeah.
But I'd forgotten about the giant helmet. I've been looking forward ever since to your episode about, just crap that falls, crazy people, crap that falls from the sky.
Yeah, I have a whole gazetteer or compendium on like news stories for the past 100 or from 1900 to 1999 on like things that have fallen out of the sky by city and state, and it's mind blowing. Well, anyway, I'm getting off topic.
That's great. And it's all right. It's all the type of or the type of it is wormwood, right? I mean that's the evil thing that falls from the sky for no reason that anybody can really figure out, and that does terrible stuff when it lands. And so the great helmet, or the rain of rocks on the roof of Carrie's mother's house or whatever. That's just wormwood is the type of all of that, I think.
Yeah.
Is the bitter star that falls and destroys a third of all life on Earth.
Yeah, and then it doesn't sound so crazy when you start looking at, geologically, like what wiped out the dinosaurs. I remember explaining this to a little niece of mine. She's like, why did the dinosaurs die? I'm like, because an asteroid came down and hit the Earth and killed them all. And she's like, well, it's an asteroid. I'm like, there are these huge rocks floating up in the sky above the clouds. And she said, why are there huge rocks floating up there? And I'm like, my God, I don't know why. And I started getting spooked.
Why would anyone do that?
Yeah, like, I don't know why. I don't know how to answer this. Let's stop talking about it right now. So I found, I don't know if you've run across this, but Charles Adams was like brainstorming this whole
with
Adams
Ray
family.
Bradbury?
Yeah, Ray this Bradbury.
Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. Go ahead.
Yeah, and so I've only recently come across, like, they published it posthumously, but these collections, like, they ended up not being, like, not getting anywhere with the project together, and so they split off. So Charles Adams did the cartoons, and Ray Bradbury started writing these short stories. Mm-hmm. And they didn't really go anywhere, but posthumously they collected them into a book called From the Dust Returned. Have you read any of this?
I have not, actually, but I've heard about the Ray Bradbury, because, where you and I are both in Illinois. Are we allowed to say that? I don't know how secret you're being about who you are. They've got my name. They know I teach at Southern Illinois University. If somebody's going to hunt me down, whatever, like, I can't do much about it. And woe betide you, by the way. Because I'm at least as well armed as you are, but since we're both in Illinois, right? It's these are stories of this family of Illinois vampires.
Yeah, these monsters or whatever they are in this house, and it's freaking adorable. Like it's. And it's like, adorable is not the right word. Like it has that like creepy feel, but entirely whimsical. Like
that's Bradbury, right? I mean, Bradbury always gets that space exactly right, I think. In a way that defies my understanding, because when I look at his prose, I always think Bradbury is juvenile.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like sentence by sentence, I'm like, oh, come on, dude. But then the overall effect is always like, oh my God, like that's what childhood is really like. And it's actually that scary and actually that sad, and actually that sentimental and actually that heroic.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when I think about Something Wicked This Way Comes, right? I mean,
yeah.
And I'm like, oh, that's exactly what, boyhood friendships are like. And it's exactly the way they end. It's like one of them gets a year older than the other. You know what I mean? And it's just this unbridgeable gap. So that doesn't surprise me at all. And I if I were better doing my homework, I'd have actually read them before I came on the show, because I wanted to talk about them. But I'm part of an English department, so I'm deeply accustomed to talking about literature that I pretend to have read.
But there's in these stories, it's like just like upper Illinois somewhere, out of the blue, one night there's this big storm and it whips up this entire like mansion, castle type of thing, flies through the air and just lands in Illinois and stays empty until one cat moves in and from Egypt who escaped out of the pyramids, and then like one spider moves in, and then like one ghost of a mouse moves in, and then these like monster families start moving
ghost
in.
Ghost of a mouse.
Yeah.
It's great.
I'll give you one paragraph to get a sense of the whimsy.
No,
in this,
please.
But it's a, so like Ray Bradbury's version of what ended up being the Addams Family elsewhere, about the house, he says, the house was a puzzle inside an enigma, inside a mystery, for it encompassed silences, each one different, and beds, each a different size, some having lids. Some ceilings were high enough to allow flights with rests where shadows might hang upside down. The dining room nested 13 chairs, each numbered 13, so no one would feel left out of the distinction such numbers implied. The chandeliers were shaped from the tears of souls in torment at sea 500 years lost, and the basement cellar kept 500 vintage year bins and strange names on the wine tucked therein, and empty cubbies for future visitors who disliked beds or high ceiling perches. Like, that's just adorable.
Wow.
I think.
That's like the sort of darling version of that opening description of Hill House. From Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House, right? You know, where, you know, the walls, I'm going to screw it up if I try to do it from memory, but you know, where the walls continue straight, whatever walked alone.
Yeah.
Like that's the, you know, and one day we should talk about adaptations maybe too, because I'd love to talk to you about The Haunting of Hill House, the 1960s film, the 1990s film, or 2000, whenever it was, and then the recent Netflix show.
Yeah.
I'd like to talk about those adaptations. And
we should.
You know,
that 60s version was good, man. That held up wonderfully.
Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievably good, which is what dooms, you know, everything that comes after. But they seem to embrace that doom. They're like, we realize we can't be good, so, you know, we're going to be horrific in a whole different way. People seem so excited about the TV show, so I watched it out of obligation to the young people who depend on my opinion, as I imagine they do. And, oh my God. Well, we don't want to get off on that, I'm sure, but at some point, but no, that's great. Like that's the Gothic, and that's a Bradbury Gothic, like, because he gets it right. And I think this is the quality we're talking about Adam's family and about the cartoons, and maybe we ought to move on, but it is that quality of, it is both the thing itself and a really sharply realized satire of the thing itself.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that it operates at both levels. And I think, you know, that those cartoons are both deeply creepy and they're really funny because they're dealing in assumptions we make about places and people who look like that and do those things, right? So, and that for me, like, that's the perfect place for narrative art, probably all art, I suppose. But all I know even a little bit about is narrative art. That's the perfect place for me for it to dwell, right? Is where it is both, you get the satisfactions of the thing itself, but there's also a kind of sly self-awareness that, you know, that says, okay, but we both understand where this is operating out of. And I will shamelessly plug your novel, The Black Palace, right? No. And I don't think it's out of place, right? I mean, I would talk about The Black Palace in this context, no matter who I was talking to about this, but it's both a really terrific, like, what do we want to call it, like a horror action novel or something like that, right? Yeah. It's absolutely, it's, you know, satisfying in the way that, you know, in the way that a good action novel with, you know, about a regular SWAT team would be satisfying, or the way that, you know, like, the Raid Redemption is really satisfying. You know, these really cool, heavily armed, you know, good guys are in a terrible, terrible place surrounded by heavily armed expert bad guys, and what's going to happen, right? And can they get, so it satisfies at that level, but there's also that there's a meta level to that book that's really enjoyable too. It's not, you're not winking at us, but we're all aware that you're referring to much older stories, and that you're consciously referring to much older stories, to really ancient material, and that you're drawing. So I think the Black Palace works in that way as well, that it's, there's a level at which it's really exciting and scary, and there's a level at which it's really funny.
Yeah. Well, I think I found that, I remember finding that with your work, like for instance, like on MTV News, when they're talking about this young Pinkney Benedict guy writing these stories out of Appalachia, in which like these huge, like man-eating hog is like on the rampage, and it's loose and people have to kill it. And like, and you know, it's a great story. It totally works in Appalachia. It totally works as a monster story, but also like you're giving, you know, New Yorkers the sense of what they think Appalachia is like.
Exactly.
And it's not that it's not that, but it's not that, you know. So.
Well, and that maybe brings me to like the, you know, the thing, as I was thinking about the subject and talking about the Addams Family, we haven't yet talked about the Munsters, and who knows how much one needs to talk about the Munsters, but there's a third monster family, right, that's just like the Munsters and the Addams Family, and that's the Beverly Hillbillies.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up, actually.
Yes.
So I guess we, a little bit of backstory, but simultaneously, Addams Family and Munsters come out in fall of 1964, and it's, you know, from the documentaries I've seen and research I've done, it's not so clear that, like, it was, like, CBS versus ABC trying to one-up each other. They were kind of just happening simultaneously. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
And yeah, then top of the charts, and you've got all these other kind of sitcoms at the time. I guess it's a reaction against like Ozzie and Harriet, Leave It to Beaver, but you've got like Bewitched, it's about a witch, or I Dream of Jeannie, suddenly is a genie.
I didn't even think about Bewitched, of course, and I Dream of Jeannie, because I was thinking, like, what are familial monsters? Like, what are monsters with families, you know? Because that's kind of the bigger question that we're talking about. Yeah, is monsters and families, and how do they exist in families? Like, monster, you know, I mean, even the word monster, right, kind of indicates a kind of isolation.
Yeah.
You know, and a kind of singularity. And so, you know, and so what do you do when you get singularities all together? You know, these things that exist alone and apart from humanity and so on and so forth. I'm sorry to interrupt, but
at the top of the charts, you've got Munsters, you got Addams, the Addams Family, and then you have Beverly Hillbillies. And and Beverly Hillbillies is a horror show, right? Like you have those monsters coming out of the dark wilderness into civilization,
and no one knows what to do with them. Exactly. And everyone in the Beverly Hillbillies deals with the Hillbillies exactly the way everyone in the Munsters deals with Herman Munster and his family, and exactly the way everyone in the Addams Family deals with the Addamses.
Yeah.
They are frightened of them. They try to take advantage of them. They assume that they're stupid, right? I mean, and the monsters always come out on top, which is why I like all of these shows. You know, and the monsters come out on top because they love each other and have a loyalty to each other that the people who aren't monsters cannot muster.
Right.
The people who aren't monsters have bad marriages, right? They try to cheat each other. They try to cheat the monsters. They, you know, they're trying to sell useless things. They're trying to take advantage. None of the monsters ever does any of that stuff.
Yeah.
And as a consequence, at the end of every episode, they win. Like, you know, and so, yeah, but that's that quality of the Beverly Hillbillies. And I'm going to get excoriated if people will go, oh, this guy claims he's a West Virginia writer, but he claims the Beverly Hillbillies is his inspiration. But that's exactly it. It's like part of what I love to do is to is to pull that stuff, right? Like go, how much of a tall tale can I tell you that you, knowing nothing about me but from the fact that I'm from West Virginia, how much of it will you buy?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And that strikes me as fundamental storytelling, and particularly fundamental rural storytelling. Right? It's like, how hairy can this dog in this hairy dog story be before you finally go, whoa, 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 wait a second. This hog was eating their livestock? You know what I mean? Like, this hog was so big and terrifying that they wouldn't leave their house for years? You know? And literally nobody ever says that. Nobody ever says, like, this defies imagination. Because as long as you say, oh, well, they're like, oh, this is a really weird story. You go, well, you know, it happened in West Virginia. They're like, oh.
Virginia,
I mean, that's Appalachian, generally, it's the id of the country.
Yeah.
Right. Anything can happen there. Oh, it's this weird, inhuman place. And so that's, the Beverly Hillbillies are just the Munsters without the, without having to spend 4 hours in the makeup chair.
Yeah. And I mean, like, some of the best episodes of The Sopranos, for instance, fit that formula to a T. Like, you've got this family of monsters that are just like tight knit, and everybody else comes along who like feels superior to them, but eventually, falls apart and doesn't hold up. In kind of when you're set against a family of tight-knit monsters. And I love that kind of thing. Well, maybe we should talk about the Munsters for a minute, because, I mean,
sure,
there's, like you pointed out, I think when we were talking about it before, how one of the clear distinctions is Munsters are like working class. Like, like Herman Munster has to leave every day. He's a gravedigger. He has to go. He's a big, like, Frankenstein's monster.
Lily hands him a briefcase, right? I think it's a briefcase. Well,
I thought it was a lunchbox. I'm remembering.
Is it a lunchbox? I hope it's a lunchbox. Yeah. I hope that you are correct and that my memory is incorrect. We'll just say it's a lunchbox.
Okay.
Until YouTube corrects us or does not correct us. Because a lunchbox is way better.
Yeah, I thought maybe
it should be a lunchbox.
I don't know. Anyway, Munsters was delightful too. It's really unfortunate that it hasn't had like a successful movie takeoff. As far as I can tell, no one really wants to dedicate the millions it would take as they did with the Addamses.
And they did it with Dark Shadows too.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can't understand why Dark Shadows would get the Johnny Depp treatment. Well, I don't understand that in the first place, because Dark Shadows is awesome. And I grew up with Dark Shadows in a way I did not grow up with either the Munsters or the Addams Family, because they were already in reruns by the time I was ever able to see them. Yeah. But Dark Shadows was actually on. Like, I remember seeing Dark Shadows. Yeah. And if anybody here doesn't know what Dark Shadows is, it was a live half-hour gothic soap opera. And it was huge. Hugely popular, and it made sex symbols out of this weird guy named Jonathan Frid, who, if you looked him up, weirdest looking little guy, but he was the sexy vampire Barnabas Collins, and this other guy named David Selby, he was the werewolf, and he was Quentin. Oh my God, I loved Quentin, the werewolf, and he's a West Virginian. David Selby grew up in West Virginia, so that's kind of one of the reasons I've met David Selby, actually, strangely enough, But Dark Shadows got the big movie treatment. And so now people who are younger than I am, which is almost everybody at this point, people who are younger than I am only know about Dark Shadows through the Johnny Depp movie, which was horrifically bad, and not through the sort of Ed Wood level television show. But that's the kind of non-comic version of the Munsters, right? It was about the Collins family, and there's Barnabas Collins, who's a vampire, and Quentin Collins, who's a werewolf, and I'm trying to remember Angelique. And Angelique was, I loved Angelique. She was a beautiful actress, and she was a witch, and she was married to Barnabas, and she had cursed him and put him in he'd been locked in a crypt for 200 years or something because of her, but he still loved her. He still carried this torch for her. Dark Shadows.
Just about everybody I know who was a kid at the time When you bring up Dark Shadows, they go, "The hand out of the grave scared me to death."
Yeah. Here it comes. And it really was scary. Like, I mean, it was, you know, that was a show that when I watched it in the afternoons, I would get home from school and Dark Shadows would be on. And it was just, you know, and that theme would come up. And it was when I first got a record player, one of the first albums I ever owned and one of the first things I ever got off of Apple iTunes when it became possible to buy songs that, you know, you hadn't heard in 30 years yeah. was the theme music and all the incidental music and stuff like that to Dark Shadows. And I still listen to it. It's so atmospheric.
Yeah. And I mean, I think at least some of my younger students sometimes are kind of surprised at finding out like how cool and out of the box so many of these shows and movies were back in an era when they're thinking, well, they think that, you know, they think now, well, that's too stereotypical and kind of demeaning, I think. But let me say it like this, like a lot of people are surprised to find that there was this gothic vampire romance drama entirely successful like decades and decades ago. Like,
and it was months, live.
It was live. Yeah. So many weird things. Like,
can you imagine? Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that's those, something the BBC would have done for Quatermass, you know, back in the 50s, right?
Yeah.
These live multi-part. And it went on for years and years and years. There are hundreds of episodes. Yeah. Of Dark Shadows.
And I mean, there's so...
I keep pushing us away from the Munsters. And I don't know why, because I actually love the Munsters. But Dark Shadows seem to me, if we're talking about monster families, you know, we've got to talk about the Collins of Collinwood.
And I mean, just awesome stuff. Well, like the Munsters too, like, you know, driving around in that like dragster that they
see,
have.
And this is why, yeah, when we talk about Munsters versus Addams Family, and or not even versus, you know, we talk about, you know, Ginger, you know, versus Marianne. I don't mean to set up a kind of dichotomy or choice or something like that, but there are aspects to the Munsters that I love that are maybe they're hokey, but maybe that's just because I love hokey stuff. But like, I love the dragster.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
It's wicked.
But they had a dragster. You know, I mean, the Adamses had a harpsichord. You know what I mean? Boom, 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 boom. And I won't do too much of that, or I'm sure iTunes will flag
YouTube,
us.
YouTube's going to sue me.
But like they had a harpsichord, and they had a butler, and and even the old witch was called Grandmama, right?
Yeah.
And you know, but the Munsters, you know, the Munsters, exactly. They had a dragster and they had like a dragon and, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, they were like, it was sort of like the Flintstones in that way, I suppose. And you know, exactly. Dragster, you think it's not so much a part of the culture now, but I mean, you know, funny cars and dragsters and, you know, street rods and stuff like that. Dragster was straight out of like Two-Lane Blacktop.
Yeah.
You know, or some, you know, some classic movie about street racing. And, you know, the fact that the Munsters like that,
yeah.
You know, that's great. Like, that puts them in my wheelhouse. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I'm like, it's not Grandmama. You know what I mean? Like, oh, they, you know, they like cars the way I like cars, the way I liked cars when I was a boy.
One behind the scenes documentary on it was saying like the studio didn't want to risk the $10,000 extra dollars it was going to take to make it color like they planned on. And so they just went black and white just to be cheap, but they spent twice that on the dragster. They spent 20 grand.
Money well spent, in my opinion.
The other one was a Dragula too. They had like the follow-up gold coffin dragster that they called the Dragula. It was just wicked, man. There was some really cool stuff. And I guess both of them only lasted 2 years, like 64 to 66. Batman came in, shut everything down that wasn't Batman on TV. And that was it. And so I kind of wonder, like, what was going on at the time in 64 that everybody just suddenly had to have monster families? And I don't know, like, surely some of it's that Universal Studios holdover a little bit, but I mean, I don't know, maybe it What's your take on that? Like, why did this magical little bubble of monster families like pop up so intensely right there?
You would think, given that you invited me to do this podcast, you know, some weeks ago, that I would have thought about that question. It's like, why the monsters and why the, and I, you know, part of me, it's a question in the classroom. It's the kind of thing, you know, I try to answer, like, you know, I try to encourage students to try to answer, you know, in my apocalyptic literature class. We're like, oh, why zombies? Like, why have zombies now eaten the entire culture? Why, yeah. You know, was, you know, at the time the most popular television show, you know, in the world, why was it about zombies? Why does that happen? And of course, you know, they're all like, oh, in the '50s, it was, you know, communism. And now it's, I don't know what it is now. And we all have our theories about that, right? I mean, for me, I'm satisfied simply to say it happened because I was born in 1964. And so they had this weird nostalgic glow about them the time I was old enough to encounter them. But I will give you rather than a societal answer, which would be completely made up and fantastical and a bunch of crap anyway, I will give you the solipsistic answer, which is that I needed them to be in reruns when I was 8.
The stars aligned. We got Benedict, Adams, and Munsters.
You know, given that I was alone on a farm, someone had to raise me, and it turned out to be the Munsters and the Adams Family and the Beverly Hillbillies and Captain Kirk when I could tune in that station.
Well, I think maybe that's a great place to end the episode, now that we know exactly how these magical things have come alive. Right.
There you go. I like to supply answers.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been really fun talking with you about these monstrous families.
Yeah, I forget that we're on the show, which is probably not great podcast, but I sort of default to my I'm just talking to Josh about interesting stuff mode. So, but I enjoyed it. I always I have enjoyed being on the show. I enjoy listening to the show. I like everything about the show.
All right. Well, thanks, and we'll brainstorm about what the next topic, because I'm definitely want to have you on again as a regular guest if I can keep swinging that. Yep. And so we'll brainstorm next time. So thanks.
My pleasure.